BTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, offering an online master's degree in health and wellness management. Learn advanced wellness program management skills and make a difference in a rewarding career in partnership with UW Extension. Details available at uwp.edu. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We will have all new morning show interviews next week, but today, a couple of interesting interviews from the archives, beginning with one that was recorded and initially broadcast way back in 2002.
I hold in my hands a really fascinating book called The Trials of Lenny Bruce, The Fall and Rise of an American Icon. And I have with me on the phone today one of the authors of this book, David M. Scover. And this is a book which comes to us from Source Books, based in Naperville, Illinois, so right down the road. And The Trials of Lenny Bruce is not only a richly detailed written account of the turbulent career of Lenny Bruce and his brush with the legal system, but it also, as is the case with so many books from Source Books, also includes an audio CD, which features excerpts from some of Lenny Bruce's most controversial or noteworthy performances, and even a few audio excerpts from some of his court appearances. And it all weaves together into a really fascinating portrait of Lenny Bruce and what his professional legal decline was really all about and what it means for us today. David Scover, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you very much, Greg. I'm glad to be here.
I would like to know right off the bat, as you undertook this project, what sort of hat were you wearing? And were one of those hats as a fan of Lenny Bruce and his work?
I've always been a fan of Lenny Bruce. You have to understand, I'm a professor of law, and one of the edicts of the legal academic profession is publish or perish, right? So we're always looking for material that we think would be useful and exciting to work on. Approximately 4.5 years ago, I was speaking to a very good friend of mine who is Nadine Strossen, president of the ACLU, and she mentioned the topic of Lenny Bruce, particularly the obscenity trials of Lenny Bruce, as a fascinating study for any First Amendment or free speech expert. And since I am a First Amendment expert, I picked up on her idea, began to look at it. And the more I involved myself in research with my co-author, Ronald Collins, the more excited I became and the more interested I was in actually publishing this book. And so it was a long labor of love, but it started out with an interest in writing something that was both important, that is, in subject matter to a general public, but exciting for me.
The subtitle of the book is interesting, The Fall and Rise of an American Icon. Explain that choice of words.
Well, you realize, of course, that the adage is generally the rise and fall, but with Lenny Bruce, it was quite the opposite. By the end of his life, Lenny Bruce's comedic career was, as he would put it, in the toilet. He had lost his audience. He was obsessed with the law, particularly his obscenity trials, and he no longer really was a celebrated comedian. So as far as his own decline was concerned, that's the fall in our title. Now, what we mean by the rise is that after Lenny Bruce died in 1966, death became his greatest publicity agent. He resurrected in a way that very few people do when they die. He became the subject of biographies, of film, of course, the famous Dustin Hoffman film in the 70s, of documentaries, of recordings when Fantasy Records issued many of his famous routines. And he, you know, and now he's the subject of this biography about his courtroom dramas in the obscenity trials. So as far as we're concerned, Lenny Bruce has resurrected. He's back.
One of the things that is interesting about the book is that unlike a more standard biography, you really do not take a lot of time laying the groundwork in terms of the rise of Lenny Bruce and so on. We're really kind of plunged pell-mell right into his career and to the legal difficulties which ensued. You do, however, give us a little brief, fascinating glimpse of the early Lenny Bruce. He was not daring and cutting edge right from the start.
That's absolutely right, Greg. The early Lenny Bruce was, like many of the comedians of his time, a one-liner doing rather hackneyed bits. In fact, in the earliest part of his career, Lenny was imitating a lot of the comedic routines that his mother, Sally Marr, who had been a burlesque house comedian, had taught him. And when it wasn't until that Lenny actually appeared in the Steve Allen show in 59 that Lenny began to show the world his new brand of comedy. He quickly became billed after that as one of the quote unquote sicknicks, a shocking comedian who was willing to use his comic flair in a biting way to the end of satirizing political and religious authorities of the day. So you're absolutely right to characterize his career as an evolution from old mother-in-law jokes and one-liners to something much, much more revolutionary in the world of comedy.
You had a couple of points during the book, quote Lenny Bruce as saying, "I'm not a comedian, I'm Lenny Bruce." At least once when you quote that, that's in the context of where he says, "I wasn't very funny tonight, sometimes I'm not. I'm not a comedian, I'm Lenny Bruce." And indeed, in some of these excerpts that we hear, we realize we're just a world away from sort of the standard comedian. And much of what he seemed to do up on the stage had very little to do with what we think of as standard comedy.
Lenny Bruce used the line, "I'm not a comedian, I'm Lenny Bruce," at the midnight performance at the Jazz Workshop in San Francisco, a performance that he went to after he had been released on bail from his first obscenity bust. And that line came to characterize his entire performance career from that point forward. Much of Lenny's comedy was extraordinarily brilliant and very, very funny. But by the time Lenny is arrested for obscenity in San Francisco, and then shortly thereafter in L.A. and in Chicago, and culminating in the 1964 arrest in New York at the Cafe Ogogo, by that time, Lenny understands that he is no longer just a comedian, and that his main purpose is not simply to be funny, that he was sacrificing his career, he was sacrificing his fortune, and ultimately he sacrificed his very life for the American principle of freedom of speech. He became a freedom of speech hero. And he began to understand that, and as he understood that, his comedy began to increasingly take the law as its central focus. He became obsessed with the law.
You talk about how actually by the very end of his career, which is essentially, I think, 1965, that by that point he is on the stage before a microphone reading from trial transcripts, and it's as though there's nothing else left for him except this year after year after year struggle with the legal system.
Well, you're right in characterizing him towards the end. Lenny's courtroom dramas became the substance of some of his acts. There's an irony, in fact, with Lenny. Lenny wanted to go into the courtroom and do his act for the judges and juries because he was determined He couldn't believe that he would be convicted of obscenity if they could only see what he was doing. And he didn't want to be characterized by the way the prosecutor and the police officers bungled his act, botched his act on the stand. And then when he would go in the courtroom at night, in the clubhouse at night, he would he'd read from his transcripts. He'd talk about his trials. So towards the end of his life, he had done an ironic twist. He was bringing his comedy into the courtroom and his courtroom dramas into the comedy club.
One of the things that is interesting as we read this book is we try to make sense of where these obscenity ordinances came from and the sort of context into which Lenny Bruce stepped. He, of course, was not the first comedian to challenge some of the prevailing tastes of the day. And you give us some sense of those who came before him who really inspired him.
Well, Lenny, there had been people who had been arrested for acts that seemed to defy the public mores on stage before him. But the difference between Lenny and anybody who had come before him is that Lenny's act was seen to be threatening to religion, to politics, to race relations, to sexual relations. Lenny ultimately was being busted, not because of his six-letter or ten-letter epithets. He was busted because the law considered him a blasphemer. In Chicago, for example, the police chief went to the Gate of Horn and in explicit terms told the club owner of the Gate of Horn that if Lenny Bruce stood up on the stage and, spoke badly about the Pope like this once again, he'd shut the place down for good. And ultimately, the Gate of Horn did close because of the Lenny Bruce performance. It never survived.
Wow.
The hit that it got from being temporarily closed down and being investigated by licensing authorities. So you see, Lenny Bruce was in a class all of his own. There probably has never been in America a single person who has been more prosecuted and persecuted for word crimes alone, for unpopular and offensive things that he said in comedy clubs, than Lenny Bruce.
How many times was he arrested in mid-act or just as a stage performance was finishing up?
There are 9 times that he was arrested for obscenity. And of those times, 7 of them went to prosecution. There were, however, only 2 trials in which he was actually convicted, one in Chicago and the other in New York. In the Chicago case, his conviction was appealed, and ultimately, because of a change in U.S. Supreme Court law, the Illinois Supreme Court reversed his sentence and conviction. But in New York, his conviction was never overturned. By that time, Lenny was bankrupt. He couldn't afford to pay for lawyers anymore. He tried to undertake his own appeal. And you know the old adage about a man who is his own lawyer is a fool. Well, Lenny botched his appeal. And he died a convicted man.
How would you characterize, first of all, Lenny Bruce's acquaintance with the legal system and some of the more sophisticated facets of the legal difficulties in which he found himself over and over again? I mean, was this a man oblivious to some of that, or did he exactly know what was transpiring around him legally and what was perhaps ahead for him?
Oh, I believe that Lenny Bruce was very, very aware of the ramifications of what he was doing. I mean, he understood how back in the 50s and 60s, he was the most controversial comedian of his day. He dared to speak the unspeakable. He was lampooning the establishment left and right by revealing hypocrisies of the religious, political, and social authorities at every turn. He never held back in what he said. He never held back in how he said it. And in fact, Lenny was an equal opportunity offender. He was willing to attack Catholics and Jews and heterosexuals and homosexuals and conservatives and liberals alike. All were targets for his searing humor. And he certainly knew that what he was getting into when he was doing it.
Well, I mean, granted, of course, he knew that he was headed for legal trouble. I guess what I'm really asking, though, is, I mean, did he have any kind of sophisticated or well-grounded sense of what was ahead for him legally? And did he have some sense that he was going to be able to come out on the other side of this successfully? I mean, did he have any kind of understanding of how legal matters like this unfold and what kind of legal battles were ahead of him? Or did he just get up on the stage and was he just interested in being the kind of comedian he wanted to be? And whatever ensued, whatever.
No, Lenny, I believe, would be better characterized by your first comment, not the second. He wasn't just someone who got up and, you know, in a hell-bent way, was just charging ahead regardless of what would occur to him. He had been schooled in the law himself, not formally, but he would read First Amendment cases of the U.S. Supreme Court and of lower courts with an avidity that would characterize, you know, an eager young student. He was aware by talking to famous attorneys who, in some cases, represented him, in some cases, didn't. People like Melvin Belli, friend of his, whom he would consult on First Amendment matters. Kunstler was another. Lenny had eventually surrounded himself with a coterie of lawyers. He hired enough lawyers to fill a medium-sized Manhattan law firm over the course of his life. And with each and every one of them, some of them whom we have on the CD that's packaged with the book when we interviewed them for the book, with every one of them, he would probe them with questions. And generally, the line of thinking was, well, now, how can this be? I mean, given the Supreme Court's ruling in such and such, how can I be prosecuted? You know, the Roth opinion says dot dot dot. I mean, Lenny was really a young student of the law.
How would you characterize the quality of his attorneys over the years? I mean, and the quality of the defense battle which they waged on his behalf.
There's no question that Lenny had probably some of the most famous First Amendment lawyers of their day defending him. He did not lack talented defense attorneys. Among the names who of the people who defended him are the famous Harry Calvin Jr. of the University of Chicago, Robert Ming, who was the first African-American professor at Chicago and who had authored the brief, along with Thurgood Marshall at the NAACP, for the famous desegregation school case of Brown versus Board of Education. His counsel in the New York case was Ephraim London, who had won before the Supreme Court of the United States in obscenity cases time and again, known as probably the most important First Amendment lawyer of his day. I mean, Lenny was not in any way underrepresented. It's just that he was at the cutting edge of obscenity law of his day, and even though he should have been vindicated by the opinions of the U.S. Supreme Court at the time, the state courts had a different view of things, and the prosecutors went after him regardless of the law. By the way, one of the most interesting twists on it is one of the most famous American lawyers today, who in fact prosecuted Lenny Bruce as a young district attorney in L.A., is Johnny Cochran Jr.
Wow.
Isn't that interesting twist?
Very interesting. You of course have all kinds of transcripts from some of these trial proceedings, and one of the things that's particularly fascinating is just trying to imagine a bunch of well-dressed lawyers in a formal courtroom discussing some of these matters, discussing some of the kinds of things that were said in these nightclub acts and so on. And in one of the New York trials, you give us an exchange between a witness and one of Lenny Bruce's attorneys, asking him, well, when's the last time you were in a nightclub? Well, it was over 20 years ago. Well, then what do you know about what's acceptable in a nightclub in this day and age? I mean, the intersection of these contrasting worlds and worldviews is fascinating.
Well, I'm so glad that you find it fascinating, Greg, because that certainly is it was our point to show the connection between what was going on in the club world at the time, in the reality, and the way that world was being treated in the courtroom. You mentioned earlier, Greg, the CD that's being packaged with the book. That CD is narrated by Nat Hentoff, who, of course, was the famous jazz critic for the Village Voice, and who testified on Lenny's behalf at the New York trial. On that CD, there is a never-before-released audio portion of Lenny's New York trial. Lenny smuggled what was then a high-tech reel-to-reel tape recorder into the courtroom in a custom-made briefcase, and unknown to the judges and prosecutor, Lenny taped the testimony of his trial, and some of that trial, never before heard, is actually available on the CD. The point of the CD is to, in a sense, revolutionize the very idea of a biography. And as people are reading through the transcripts or reading about the comedy routine, they are meant to listen to the that routine or that testimony to get a flavor of both Lenny Bruce's comedy and the virulence with which the prosecutors went after Lenny in his obscenity trial.
We have just a couple of minutes left. One of the most important questions I wanted to ask you was Lenny Bruce in fact guilty of breaking the laws that were on the books, or were at least some of these arrests utterly unjust? Now, I'm not asking about whether or not the laws themselves were just, but at least in some cases, was Lenny Bruce in violation of the law?
There's no question that some of the laws under which Lenny were being prosecuted were inconsistent, at least in the application to him, inconsistent with the governing Supreme Court precedent in obscenity law at the time, which was the famous Roth case written by William Brennan. And it's our opinion that that case, although very complex and one that could be read several ways, ultimately vindicated Lenny Bruce's type of comedy. And the prosecutors that went after him, as police officers that went after Lenny Bruce, were not really giving a very fair read to the state of national obscenity law at the time, to consider his important political commentary and his important satire, to consider it just dirty word crime.
Hmm. Oh, just a word about the final days of Lenny Bruce and his ultimate fate.
Well, I would say that the final days of Lenny Bruce prove to us what this book is geared to do. This book is a cautionary tale about a great American principle, the principle of freedom of speech, which is extremely fragile and always has to be fought for. And Lenny Bruce's life was sacrificed in order that the idea of prosecuting comedians for off-color language would end. Above all else, that is Lenny's legacy.
The book is The Trials of Lenny Bruce, the Fall and Rise of an American Icon. David M. Scover is one of the authors, joined by Ronald K. L. Collins. This book and its companion compact disc are published by Sourcebooks Media Fusion. Professor Scover, it's been a real pleasure talking with you, and I thank you for your work on this fascinating book.
Thank you very much, Greg. It's been delightful to talk to you, too.
You're listening to The Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. For part two of The Morning Show today, we turn back to the archives, although not all the way back to 2002. Our second interview of today's program was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2013. We're spending this portion of WGTD's Morning Show talking about, of all things, quitting. Quitting, which is one of the things that most of us want least to do in our lives. We are reluctant to quit. We tend to look down on those that we regard as quitters. It's one of the worst things you can sort of attach to somebody, calling them a quitter. But in fact, we need to think about quitting or goal disengagement, if you want to think of it in more proper, thoughtful terms. We need to think about this much more thoroughly. And in fact, some of the best decisions that a person can make in their own lives might very well involve quitting versus just sort of mindlessly persisting in pursuit of a particular dream or desire. And sometimes it means letting go of something which is not ever going to happen. And sometimes it means letting go of something that you do have, but which no longer gives you the pleasure or satisfaction that perhaps it once did, or is perhaps undermining your well-being in other ways. In other words, we should not be simplistic when we think about or talk about quitting. Hence the value of this fascinating new book called Mastering the Art of Quitting: Why It Matters in Life, Love, and Work. It's written by Peg Streep and by my guest today, Alan Bernstein, who has written extensively on topics regarding changes in life, transitions between various careers and professions. He serves on the faculty of the New York Medical College and New York University's doctoral program in psychotherapy. So he comes at this topic from a perspective of expertise on a couple of different levels. This book is published by Dacapo, again called Mastering the Art of Quitting. Alan Bernstein, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Well, thanks so much, Greg. I'm very happy to be here, and that was a great introduction. The issue for quitting, and I think you touch on it lightly, but I want to talk about it a little more, is that we're hardwired to persist. In other words, there are all kinds of unconscious biases in our personality which keep us going probably long after what we're doing serves us well. And we tend to create all kinds of ideas about why we should persist. But really what they do is protect us from the fear or anxiety of being labeled losers or acknowledging that we made a mistake along the way. And the value of our book lies in helping people understand how they can withstand the psychological assault of being labeled a quitter or a loser, and be able to recognize that it may be in their best interest to persist in a different direction rather than the one they've chosen.
This topic is near and dear to me on a couple of different levels. Most recently, my thoughts about the topic were pricked by seeing a film, which, by the way, I absolutely loved, called Saving Mr. Banks or Mrs. Banks, I'm trying to remember, but it's the film about Walt Disney and the woman who wrote Mary Poppins. And I loved the film, but part of the point of that film is at one point, or several points, Walt Disney is heard kind of spouting what was such a central theme of his life, that if you sort of wish hard enough and work hard enough, your dreams will come true, which has been told to us in song and verse and all kinds of things. But even in the context of this really thoughtfully made and beautifully moving story and film, I found myself just bothered all over again by that myth, which is not proffered just by Walt Disney, but by lots of other people as well, that it's all about not letting anything dissuade you from a particular goal. And because I happen to be a music professor, a teacher of voice,
I also think about this in terms of my own students, many of whom have lofty aspirations to someday be on a Broadway stage or the stage of the Metropolitan Opera. And what is one to do with those kind of goals and dreams? Maybe not discard them altogether, but at some point they maybe are dreams simply beyond our reach. I wonder if you could react to any of that, and maybe on top of it, say a word about what prompted you and your co-author to address this matter of quitting in this book.
Well, you raise a couple of really interesting points. I didn't happen to see that film, but in truth, I mean, the most blatant version of the persistence myth is Rocky, and you know the five or six films that have been made after that, which captures a particularly American idea about persistence that you can't be done in by simple things like, you know, fighting a fighter who's much better than you, that if you keep going, somehow you'll triumph. And, of course, the truth is, as you point out with some of your students, some of them won't triumph, and the most flexible and most careful among them will be able to pick up the parts of their career that make sense for them, whether they become teachers or coaches or whatever happens to their music, or whether it becomes a hobby. But the point is to be able to work with a spectrum of interests. Now, both Peg and I left careers. We were both, oddly enough, in the same program. We were both taking PhDs. She was at Columbia and I was at Rutgers, and we were both in the middle of our dissertation. I found at that point that my teaching career was really an error. The part I liked about teaching was being with my students and helping them, you know, select ideas about themselves, and that I had gone into because I loved to read and confused loving to read with loving to teach. at the academic level, teaching is about research. And unless you're prepared to do research, you're going to be teaching English 101 for the rest of your life. And that was not what I wanted to do. And I had to go back to school and start over. And I remember to this day the sense of humiliation I felt at having made a mistake of that magnitude. Now, I was in my 20s, so I was lucky in the sense that people are very forgiving about change in the 20s. But as you get on in my 30s and 40s, it becomes much harder because the weight of feeling that you made an error is so much more powerful. One of the biases that we talk about in the book, and it's very well known in economics, is what they call the sunk cost fallacy. And that means we've sunk so much cost, so much energy, so much money, so much time, so much of ourselves, that at this point it becomes almost impossible to give it up. And, you know, in very practical terms, we face that in everyday life. My wife and I have an older Honda, and I brought it into the shop a couple of weeks ago because a light had come on, and they said, well, it's going to be about $2,000 worth of work. And we had to decide at that point whether it was worth it or not. In other words, were we throwing money at a car that was really kind of going to be an ongoing suck of money, or were we rebuilding a car that would last us a few years? And that's a very simple version of the sunk cost fallacy, but in real life, people face that kind of decision all the time. Have they put in money, time, effort, self into a profession that's not going to pay them back, and it's not going to give them the feelings they need to feel motivated and that they're doing the right kind of work in life, or should they be thinking in terms of starting a new career? Now, if they do want to start, what we've observed, Greg, is that there is a powerful impulse at that point to go into what we call an optimistic bias. That is the orientation towards thinking in the idea that you'll be able to work it out. But we find that it's much more advantageous if you actually write down where you're going to go, what the direction is. That, in fact, as they say in business, you want a pessimist to choose the business and then an optimist to push it through. And that's true as well in career. You want to think pessimistically. In other words, you want to think of the possible gains and the possible losses going forward before you commit yourself to it. But once you commit yourself to it, you move ahead with all the vigor you can. And that's really what's going to replace the sense of loss, opportunity that people go through. We can't We can't protect people from that. It's hardwired into our society, into our civilization. But we can give them the ability to actually have the fortitude by setting up goals for themselves, by setting up a new version of themselves that they can take into the future.
I want to ask you about one other factor involved in our tendency to persist beyond what is maybe fully productive or beneficial for us. And I love the way you kind of pick it apart, how often our tendency to do that, to be, in a sense, overly persistent,
right,
or is often tied up in several different things. One of them you talk about,
yeah,
is listening to anecdote. And this is tied up in something very fancy sounding, availability heuristic.
Right.
But it has something to do with our tendency to be swayed maybe too quickly or too profoundly, mm-hmm, by an inspiring story or a,
exactly,
vivid example. Tell us,
yeah,
more about that. It really,
yeah,
flies in the face of the way a lot of people like to sort of talk about,
yeah,
life and,
yeah,
the way they make decisions.
I mean, the availability heuristic means that we tend to think most immediately and most clearly about the stories that are around us. For example, if I were to ask you which is more likely to be the animal which does you in, a shark or a cow, most people would say shark. Because if you read the newspapers, every time somebody gets bitten or eaten by a shark, it's usually a tremendous newspaper headline. Yet, in truth, by far, the largest number of animal accidents are with cows. And we don't tend to think of that, but that's the way it is. So our mind gravitates towards what we call availability heuristic. It gravitates towards the stories we've heard most recently or most vividly. And we do that without a sense of logic. We do that with a sense of instinct and immediacy. Daniel Kahneman talks about this in some of his work, that there are two layers of thinking, one of being quick and instinctive and the other being logical in a deep sense of analytic and thoroughgoing, and what I would call a kind of pessimistic turn of mind, where you actually look at the facts from a deeper point of view of analysis.
We're speaking with Alan Bernstein, and we're talking about his book, Mastering the Art of Quitting, Why It Matters in Life, Love, and Work. And as we've been exploring in these first few minutes, part of the book explores why we are, as Mr. Bernstein stated it, sort of hardwired to persist, sometimes in pursuit of fruitless goals, or maybe in pursuit of goals that we probably should not have begun pursuing in the first place, because they're either unattainable or going to lead us down very dark paths of even self-destruction, perhaps. And sometimes we end up attaining something, but persist in it even past the point where it is giving us any pleasure or satisfaction whatsoever.
Or where the point where we deny that we're being damaged by it. I mean, I have in my practice a certain number of people who have what they call golden handcuffs, who say, I'd like to quit, but I can't afford to, and deny themselves the opportunity to think about what that means or how they can actually work with it constructively. And really what it is an attempt to protect themselves from the anxiety of loss and of feeling they've wasted time and effort.
And I have to say that's one thing that I tell voice students all the time, that the likelihood, particularly of pursuing, for instance, a performance career in opera, the odds are stacked against you because the opportunities are just out there, are not as numerous as the many aspiring singers, but that in many cases, pursuit of that goal can lead you to all kinds of unanticipated good things and blessings in your life, even if ultimately that initial or original goal is not achieved. I suppose that's that's a different kind of life path we're talking about.
Well, but that's if you're available to look at the options. I mean, one of the examples we use in the book, it's a famous experiment. People are asked to look at two teams who are playing basketball, and they're asked, one team is dressed in black and one team is dressed in white, and they're asked to notice how many times the white team passes the ball between them. And what they do in the middle of this clip that people are watching is a gorilla, a man in a gorilla suit, enters into the middle of the basketball game, beats his chest, and then exits. Now, unbelievably, 60% of the people watching this do not notice the gorilla. And that's what's called, we call that intentional blindness, which is that when you're intent on pursuing something so powerfully and with such vigor, you can actually lose the opportunity to see what's really going on. And, of course, when you know, everybody imagines that they won't be able to miss this gorilla, but it stays pretty clear at about 60-65% of the people don't see it, even though you can't imagine you'd be one of them. And so what we're saying about intentional blindness is that we also recommend that you stay alive and awake to other options, as you're saying. If, you know, what else can you do with the fact that you love music and you love singing if you're not one of the one in a thousand that's actually going to pursue a career as an opera singer?
Right, or be an NFL quarterback or an astronaut or whatever lofty right. goal you might have in your sights.
You've been exploring my dreams, I see.
So your book is not only about why we tend to be overly persistent, but of course your book is also about, as the title suggests, the art of quitting. And I'm so struck by the fact that at various points in the book you will use terms like quitting fully, yeah, or quitting with authority and intelligence, or
right,
quitting artfully. It's so intriguing because it makes us realize that what you're talking about here is quitting that is very different from the kind of quitting that we probably most often hear,
yeah,
about and don't think very highly of. Right. In fact, you discuss some of this, the different kinds,
right,
of poor,
yeah,
quitting.
We have the stealth quitter, a guy who sneaks out. We have the faux quitter, someone who pretends to quit, but in actual fact, they're just engaged at a superficial level. I mean, there's all kinds of negative quitting styles that are not at all what we're talking about. What we're talking about is a full disengagement from all the energy that went into that goal and a re-engagement with a new goal that is actually amplified if people write it down and the steps that are going forward and anticipate what might go wrong. In other words, the closer you come to preparing yourself for all the options going forward, what we call mental contrasting, more likely it is that you will be successful going forward.
Hmm. I really appreciated chapter 3, which is Quitting as an Art, in which you,
right,
talk about letting go on every level, something,
right,
which is not as easy as it might think, especially because, exactly, I think a lot of us, if all you know of quitting is the thought of stomping out the door, slamming the door behind,
right,
you, that there's nothing,
right,
easier than that. But you're,
right,
talking about something else, and on a very scientific sort of level, talk about this idea of letting go, of disengaging on various levels, cognitively,
right,
and otherwise.
Right.
Talk us through those levels of disengagement, because this is in many ways the heart of the matter.
Right. The cognitive disengagement is the decision that this is not the right experience for you. And most people can do that in some way. However, we do find there's also a number of other levels of disengagement. For example, there's what we call affective disengagement. In other words, letting go of the feeling of this is the only career for me. And you have to acknowledge at that point you're going to go through a series of steps through that, similar to grief steps. You start with, first of all, once you realize that this may not be the career, most people counterintuitively put more energy into saying that's a mistake until you realize that you're actually working against yourself. And then there's a feeling of blame and anger. Why did this happen? Who caused it? And after that, there is some feeling of sadness and regret. And these things can take place all at the same time. They're not necessarily consecutive until you then re-choose. And at that point, you're free to what we call do motivational engagement, that you move the energy that went into the former career or the former choice into a new direction what will motivate you that in that? And finally, there's the behavioral reengagement, that you put all your energy at that point into whatever the new career choice is, and you've actually made the shift. But we've defined these four levels because we can't stress enough the power of not wanting to be shamed by having made the wrong choice, that sunk cost fallacy. And so we really talk about, in a sense, moving the energy from the past into the future, and that it's a learned process. It's not an automatic process.
As our time dwindles away, I want to make sure to give you a chance to expand a little bit on one point in the book that I think is also very much worth making, and that is the fact that the power of positive thinking is not something that maybe we should entirely discard.
Yeah.
But it is so important to use that sparingly, wisely in one's life. As someone who has helped a lot of people try to make decisions related to this, what is the role of positive thinking in how we look at ourselves and our lives and the decisions we need to make?
Well, we refer to it in the book as the optimistic bias, that people tend to, in their wave of optimism, they can overlook the possible things that are going to get in their way. They vastly, for example, overrate how long they'll feel good if they get, say, a new position or a raise, or we ask people to recognize that there is this optimistic bias, and to use what we talked about a little earlier, the mental contrasting, to be able to anticipate the possibilities of things that are going to get in the way and how you're going to deal with them. And we ask people to think of their future goals not in terms of imperatives like, I will do this, but rather in terms of challenges, in terms of, will I do this? So that they enter into the research mode with their own thinking rather than the black-white, going forward, kind of unilateral, I will. We find that will I, and the research supports this, anticipates the future.
Your book is full of practical solutions on taking apart the process of quitting and how quitting is something we need to view in various steps, almost like the steps of grieving in a sense, and that that ultimately good things await someone if you find yourself in a position where it's really time to, in a sense, reboot your life, redirect it, that quitting sometimes means taking us off of a path that we are better off abandoning. We simply need to be mature enough to look past the little engine that could and the other myths with which we tend to be overly preoccupied. One thing I want to say in closing is I appreciate how this book goes way beyond the theoretical, that you and your co-author have obviously thought in very practical terms. And I suppose that springs in large measure from the fact that you've really sat across from all kinds of people, probably hundreds of people by now, and helped them grapple with this very matter.
That's true, but I also lived it, which I think is the engine that could.
The book is Mastering the Art of Quitting, Why It Matters in Life, Love, and Work, published by Doc Hoppo Press. Alan Bernstein, thank you so much for writing this marvelous book. I foresee it being very helpful to many people, and I enjoyed talking with you about it.
Great, Greg. Take care.
Monday on The Morning Show, Ann Bossom and her new book published by National Geographic called Ensnared in the Wolf's Lair, Inside the 1944 Plot to Kill Hitler. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm reading that wrong. On Monday's morning show, I'm sorry, we talk to the great-granddaughter of Ida B. Wells, who has just written a new book about her extraordinary great-grandmother, who, of course, one of the most significant civil rights figures in the 19th and early 20th century.